Hello, and welcome back, listeners, to the Dark Matter Magazine podcast. This, as always, is an audio presentation of the short fiction, interviews, and features you'll find in the issues of Dark Matter Magazine. We strive to curate the best and darkest of sci-fi and horror from both new and established voices. This podcast is no different. Listener discretion is advised. You can find the complete collection of our archived issues, as well as Dark Matter Inc.'s published and upcoming novels, like I Can See Your Lies, at darkmattermagazine.shop. And now to today's presentation, a special interview with the author of Haunted Reels, The Beginning, and about her upcoming novel, I Can See Your Lies, Izzy Lee. Named as one of AV Club's 10 female filmmakers to hire, Izzy Lee is a two-time Rondo Award-nominated director. She's also produced and written several award-winning shorts, growing her loyal following of underrepresented fans with every release. Lee's socio-political tales have screened at major international genre festivals such as Fright Fest, Fantasia, Overlook, Morbido, Brooklyn Horror, Boston Underground, Cinepocalypse, Chattanooga, Horrible Imaginings, and more. And without further ado, let's jump into the interview. You wear a lot of hats in production. You're a producer, you're a director, you're a writer for film. Do you feel like you have to put on a different persona for the day when you're showing up to do one job specifically, or are you just always Izzy?
I'm just always me. I mean, the jobs meld together in my world, so it's not really one thing or another, but sometimes, you know, you do just have to stop for a second, put on a different hat, and think about it from a different perspective. For instance, if I was a writer alone and not a producer or also a director, I might have problems with what I would have to do as a producer or a director on set if I, writer Izzy, was not on set. Do you know what I mean? We're at the tail end of filming my first feature film, and there are just so many things that come up that you would never plan for. And these are things like limitations of a location, losing location, making changes right at the moment. For instance, when you know, everything looks fine and even, you know, as perfect as it can be on the page. But then when you hear the words out loud and they're spoken by the actors, you might hear a false note and be like, all right, well, let's look back at what happened in the last two scenes and let's figure out why this suddenly no longer works. It could have been that we changed an inflection or an energy. It could have been that the actor could not access a particular very deep-rooted source of a well of emotion, and that's totally fine. It just means you have to go in a different direction, and sometimes that works out pretty damn well. We call these happy accidents. But you know, if I was solely a writer and I was not able to be on set, you could see how like these changes could be upsetting, you know what I mean?
Right.
And I find it easier to wear at least two hats in that particular sense, because as a writer, I fucking love writers and I don't like upsetting them. And I prefer if I'm working with something that's not my own material or something that I've co-written to have them around as much as possible, because in indie film, you know, it's really usually not just one hat or two. It's like 10. And I'm not kidding. Like, I can list off the titles of all the crew jobs that I've been working. And it's a lot of insanity, at least at this level on a micro budget. I hope not to have to, continue doing micro budgets, but here we are. And we've been creating some really, really, really great stuff. So I'm excited.
Well, it's amazing that you can spin all those plates and still find time to write a slap of a novel. I was so curious, like, as I was reading it, how writing it felt different from screenwriting transferring to prose. Have you written prose before?
I have. I've previously done short stories. I've got a handful of those published in various anthologies and magazines being defunct, unfortunately. But yeah, Haunted Reels, I've got a story that's a sci-fi horror called The Beginning, as you know. I've been actually writing most of my life. I have a trunked handwritten novel that I wrote when I was like a teenager and into my 20s in composition notebooks, long form, you know, like a billion years ago. But it was just, it was something I never thought that I could really do as any sort of, I don't know if you call it a living or whatever. I just never really attempted to get published until about a decade ago, living in Massachusetts, I met a number of wonderful horror and thriller authors, crime authors, but primarily I met a gentleman named Christopher Golden. Chris, he remains one of my biggest and oldest supporters. And I just, you know, I was talking to him, you know, one time in a group of writers at a convention called Nikon. And that's a really cool horror writers convention. Usually it's Massachusetts. Massachusetts or New Hampshire. It used to be Rhode Island for a bit. Anyway, it's New England and it's really cool. We showed a short film of mine there called Postpartum way back, and that starred Casey Lansdale, who is the daughter of Joe and Karen Lansdale. And anyway, so I met Chris and a number of other authors through Casey, got to know each other, and they were very, very kind and accepting. And Chris was like, send me a story. And I'm like, okay, why not? And I did. And he was like, you can write. And I'm like, oh, well, maybe I will try, you know, and since then I have been. So, yeah, I allot Chris in terms of at least encouragement and friendship. And he's provided me a really wonderful cover blurb for I Can See Your Lives. So I'm very, very grateful to him for his support.
That really is, that's so like a human experience.
Yeah.
We'll do things, but we won't realize that, oh, well, I can actually be really good at this until somebody from an outside perspective, like, holds the thing that we've done up to our faces and they're like, this is good. Do more of this.
Yeah, it's really wonderful. And a lot of people don't think to send the elevator back down, but Chris is one of those kind, kind souls that absolutely does. My life has been all the richer knowing him. So hopefully we'll get to work together on something or other one day. We've been trying for a bit, but it remains elusive so far. We'll see. Fingers crossed.
Even with your short story in Haunted Reels, The Beginning, and I Can See Your Lies, there's this pervasive and carrying theme of mother-daughter relationships. What draws you to that?
Yeah, I mean, I would just say sparkling childhood trauma.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, there are always going to be themes that pop up in any artist's work. And that happens to be one of them. And I never really sought that. There's also the father wound, you know, mm-hmm. and I've got stuff with damaged men being, you know, very terrible people all over the place in my work as well. So there's, you know, there's a lot of that. But you can take a look at anyone's work. And if you read or watch enough of it or what have you, whatever medium it is, patterns start to emerge. And generally, you know, we don't plan these patterns. They just sort of come out.
Right.
It's basically the art of creation is therapy, more or less.
The soul wants to tell you things that you yourself have not realized, but your soul's like, hey, when you figure it out, you're ready.
Totally.
I did notice that in I Can See Your Lies, the generational trauma, ooh, it hits. The toxicity that trickle feeds down from, like you said, these damaged men who are flailing around, mm-hmm. hurting everyone around them without seemingly a care for the damages that they do. It just makes for a haunting villain that is so scarily everyday. You don't want that to be true, but we hear and see all these things from friends, from the news, from even our own lives. And I just want to let you know, it came through very powerfully when I was reading.
Thank you for saying that. I appreciate it. It's it was a hard book to write. I'm not going to lie. It took me a bit. Then I had to go back and share it you know, with a first draft when I was finally ready for, you know, and when I say first draft, I let it sit. I went back to it. I reread it. I made edits myself. I did it a couple of times before I was even ready to share a quote unquote first draft. One of those first readers was Sadie Hartman, who is, you know, responsible for it getting published when I pitched it to her. She was like, yes, send this to me.
Sadie's wonderful.
And she loved it. So after that, then I've got developmental edits that came in, and then I spent the entire summer on it. And between, you know, writing this film, which deals with similar issues, and writing the book, I was just like, oh my God, I cannot live in such a dark place for like a year. I have to have some sunlight. So I'm hoping the next thing I do is an absurdist comedy. I tend to go back and forth because I need to talk about this dark stuff, but then it gets so ominous. It gets heavy and oppressive. And I'm just like, no, I can't fucking live like this anymore. I don't care. I'm suffering. And I think it comes through. I think great works of art, I don't think they have to be born from pain, but often they are. And that's just, it is what it is. You know what I mean? I don't like perpetuating the stereotype of a suffering artist. I think it sucks, but it's been my experience, unfortunately. So, you know, when I'm able, I like to get out and do really weird, funny things. Like I've got a short film that played the festival circuit called Meat Friend, and that toured for like 2.5 years. It got nominated for like a Fangoria Chainsaw Award, which is super cool.
Oh my gosh, congrats.
Thanks. There's another weirdo short film I did a couple years back called The Obliteration of the Chickens, which is sort of an absurdist look at this hyper-consumer dystopian society that we live in, particularly in corporate America, written from a sort of Werner Herzog and Nietzsche point of view, narrated by my friend and author Bracken McLeod, who does like kind of a funny Herzog impression. And that did pretty well. So, you know, I like to mix up because it's really hard to live in such darkness, you know?
Oh my gosh, yeah. And there is the notion that great art must be born of suffering. And I don't think that's necessarily true. I think a lot of pieces of art are born of very strong emotions, but I think a lot of the very visceral human connective tissue stories of like the fabric of the collective unconscious are born of, you know, experiences that we have suffered and we recontextualize for connecting with an audience. And I think that's incredibly powerful.
Yeah, most of us haven't been having a really good time the last few years.
I'm immunocompromised, so I've just been like in my cave for 4 years. And
oh man, Jesus. God, that sucks. I'm so sorry. Yeah, that's really hard.
Ah, it's okay. I just got a new cat this week, so something new has happened.
Oh, good. That's great. I love cats. Cats are the fucking best.
Do you have any pets?
I had two kitties, longtime kitties. I had them for 15 years apiece. They both died during the pandemic, which made it even worse.
Understandable.
Right? Yeah, the film that I'm working on now called House of Ashes is the porn version, by the way. House of Ashes. Oh, Jesus Christ. I knew I was going to do this at some point. I just didn't know how soon it was going to be. So there's the joke ready.
I mean, I would watch House of Ashes for sure.
We have a number of dearly departed furry friends in the film. They're in photographs all around us here at the location. And the entire feature is, I said it last week, but it's even more true this week. This film is a living memorial because I was always going to dedicate whatever my first feature was to Helena Hutchins, the cinematographer who got fortunately killed on the set of Rust by Alec Baldwin, and indirectly him and his producers very, 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 very erroneous business practices of cutting corners. That should never happen on a set, ever, 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 ever. I shadowed my friend Adam Egypt Monitor on the SpectreVision feature Arch Enemy, and she was our cinematographer, and that really fucked me up. And that was a pandemic thing too. And then so I was just like, whatever it's going to be, whenever it's going to be, like, you know, it's going to be in loving memory of Helena and also our furry pets. But also now my other half just had a death in the family this week. Super fun.
while we're shooting, and it will also be dedicated to the loving memory of his stepfather, Alan Russell. So it's been a really fun time this week. It's been a rough week, but what you do is you, if you're lucky enough to have a community of close friends that do the same thing in your corner the way I am lucky enough to have, I've been able to get a lot of really kind, loving support and advice from filmmaker friends who, horribly enough, have been in very similar or the same situations. And so that has been fortifying and healing to me. We had a desert shoot for one day last night in the desert down out near Joshua Tree. The location is owned by the actress who stars in the film. Her name is Fina Sanchez, and she plays Mia. And it was very special for her to have us there filming. It was really a peaceful place. And at the very, very, very end of everything, when we had wrapped the location, we all stood around by the fire and spoke a few words. And it was so beautiful and healing and magic. And I really needed it. And it was wonderful. I'm very, very grateful. So I am able to compartmentalize today. And, you know, just move forward and do everything that I need to do. You know, my filmmaker friends have all said, like, look at, they would want you to live your dreams. They would want you to keep moving forward. So what you do is you compartmentalize and you focus, even though the world is on fire around you every day, all day long.
Yeah.
And you just think about this shot. Okay. Checked off. Then the next shot. Okay. What do we need to do for this one? Oh, we need to adjust for this circumstance or that one. Or, oh, there's a jackhammer next door. Okay. This neighbor has decided to build his own driveway while we're filming. Cool. Let's figure out what we can do about that. Is there a solution? There have been a family of skunks following us around this property every night. One of them, at least, I think one, maybe more. I don't know. Maybe they died out of spite, but they crawled under the steps outside and decomposed. And now we have LA sanitation waiting for them.
Oh, no.
To come remove a dead fucking skunk. It's been insane, the amount of issues that we have. But apparently, that's indie filmmaking. And it's problem after problem after problem. Indie filmmaking is 90% crying, begging, and problem solving. And the 10% of the rest of it is all like everything else you would think it would be: writing and acting and directing and enjoying things, playing at festivals or whatever. But yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot of work, and it's a lot of fucking no sleep, and it's a lot of trauma. So writing books is a really nice change.
It's a change of pace, at least.
It's fairly peaceful. I don't have anyone to rely on but myself, you know.
And you don't have to worry about dead skunks.
Yeah. And if there are, I can like take my MacBook and leave, you know.
Yeah.
It's a lot. Like, it's not easy to write a book, but it's in relation an entirely different universe. So and I don't think I answered your question earlier about writing for prose versus writing for film. Those are very different skill sets. One of these things is not like the other. I would say it's interesting. You would think that if you could do one, you could do the other. But the amount of people that I know that can do both at least well is low. And that's not an insult to anybody. It's just a fact. It's a very kind of strange mechanism or something. But there's different formatting for sure. That's the least of it. But you have to think in different ways. You know, script writing is concise, whereas a novel or a short story, novella, what have you, you can write as long as you want about whatever you want. And you don't have to worry about like, oh, hitting a beat in order to move on to the next motivated scene and whatever. Like, you can take as much leisurely time as you like and explore the world. You can have so much inner dialogue. You can have so much description. Writing for a film is an entirely, entirely different beast and skill set. It's deceptively not simple. So hats off to anyone who can do one, the other, or both, because I got to tell you, writing is hard. Everyone thinks they can do it. No, not well, anyway.
it's kind of like driving stick or driving a boat well. Like, sure, there are people that can do both, but you're probably going to do one a little better than the other.
Oh, yeah, totally.
And I think that that follows through with a lot of different types of art. I went to school for traditional animation and then VFX.
Oh, nice.
Let me tell you, I was way better at hand drawing than I was at figuring out render cues and node structures. And they're just different beasts.
Yeah.
And I saw that you're an abstract painter, right?
I am. You know, I went to art school as well. And I have a BFA in illustration, which I never use because I don't enjoy it. You know, I think it's cool. I really love illustrators. I love, like, I used to want to be a book cover artist, album cover artist. All of these careers have been going away for a really long time. But when it became, oh, you have to be a graphic artist, you have to learn all this stuff, all these programs, all of these commands, like, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, that just takes the joy out of it for me.
Oh my gosh, I know, right? Like, I don't want to have to learn a billion programs. I just want to draw.
Yeah, I hate it. I need instantaneous relief, let's call it.
Yes.
You know, it's more of a therapy for me than anything else. And so the illustration work that I used to do, it, you know, it's more technical, it's placement, it's framing, it's, I want to say lighting, but it's not lighting. It's like working with colors and simulating lighting and textures and things like that. And honestly, you know, it really helps me prepare for being a director in terms of framing a shot, or let's talk about color theory, or, you know, perspective.
That's such an excellent point I hadn't considered.
Yeah, it's really cool. I'm glad I had that education, but abstract art is just, it's raw emotion for me. I've got a couple of paintings. I did a pair specifically for this film, which I brought down and I'm looking at right now, hanging on the walls for the location. And it became just sort of like this necessity where I had to remove some large mirrors because they're going to be, you know, reflecting my crew. And you can't have that in a movie. That's bullshit.
Right.
You know, so I'm like, all right, well, what can I do? I can either buy some bullshit at Marshall's that's mass produced by someone in a foreign country, or I can create my own and let's make my life harder, but it's going to be cooler and I'm going to be proud of it. You know what I mean?
Painting's cathartic.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, and again, with art, illustration is vastly different as a skill set from abstract art. You know what I mean? It's just entirely wonderfully strange, different skill sets.
Do you have any particular visual artists that you draw inspiration from? That's a big question. There are a lot, but
I mean, if you had asked me back in high school, I would have said Van Gogh for sure. Edvard Munch, a little Kandinsky, a lot of really great surrealists, Man Ray for sure, Picasso's Blue Period, all these guys, most of these guys were total assholes too, so.
Oh, I believe it.
I don't like to give them credit, but, you know, what am I going to do about it? I wasn't there, I didn't make history, I didn't kick the women artists out of history. And these days, I just scroll Instagram and I follow modern abstract painters, and I love how they work with color, and I love how they do. They're really cool abstract seascape painters out there that I admire, who I don't remember the names of right now. But Instagram's been really lovely for discovering.
Instagram does have a very bustling artist community, and that's something I just love to see as I'm scrolling through. I'm like, that's a beautiful style.
Yeah. Do you want to hear a really cool experience that I just remembered?
Of course I do.
I met David Bowie back when I was in art school. And
really?
Yeah. I got to talk to him about art, German Expressionism and Kandinsky, and even a few contemporary modern American artists like Julian Schnabel. But yeah, I had won a fucking radio contest for a private performance that they were hosting with David Bowie and his guitarist, Reeves Gabrel, at the time. And they did a acoustic show. There's the two of them at Ford Apache Studios in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I was one of the winners and I took my mom. He was at the edge of this wooden stage, 10 feet away, signing autographs. And I was just looking up at him like, oh my God, what is this life? And my mom, who's, you know, from the 70s, huge Bowie fan, you know, she just shoved me at the stage. She said, go.
And I went and I talked to him about painting. And he looked at me and his eyes lit up. And he was like, oh, yes, German expressionist. Oh, my, I'm not going to attempt to, like, you know, do an impression. But it was like looking at God, right? It was like he was the suavest motherfucker I've ever met. And it was just an incredible experience. This radio contest, by the way, it was like, you have to call in. You had to be the right caller. And it was, if you could ask David Bowie, what question would you ask David fucking Bowie, right? And anyway,
I don't even know.
Right. So mine was about art. Not many people, at least in mass audience here in America, knew he was ever an artist.
I didn't know.
Yeah. So exactly. See, it's like a well-known thing, but not at all a well-known thing. It's like if you search deep enough, you'll find it. But it's not. He was always known for music, of course, and then for acting as well, but never really for art unless you dig. So there was an MC that walked around the audience, you know, in intermission, like, ask your question, whatever. I didn't get picked. So that was like why my mom shoved me at the stage afterwards. But there was one jerk. I'll never forget it, how stupid it was. This is how stupid. And we're talking like, this is like 97, okay? This is a long time ago. And this guy was like, if you could be a sandwich, what kind of sandwich would you be, David Bowie?
You shitting me?
I'm not fucking kidding.
Oh, my God.
Like, how dare you? How dare you?
What did he say, though?
You know, he said, oh, no. No, thank you. Next, please. He's like, I'm not going to answer that. Yeah. And why should you fucking answer that? Stupid, stupid waste of a fucking moment. Oh, my God. Anyway, I got to ask my question and it was really nice. So there's your nice memory that I had to share.
The amount of dominoes in a life that had to fall together to have that situation happen is beautiful and so special. Like,
thank you. It's one of my most treasured memories and experiences, for sure.
Well, speaking of sandwich guy, one of the big themes I was picking up on that Finn stated a couple times throughout, it was just pervasive and I can see your lies, was women all over the world, but especially in America, feeling like second-class citizens just for existing in a world with men. And I think a lot of guys don't realize that because, like, the systems are not built to benefit us. And even when we are attempting to be honest with people in authority, finger quotes, we're disbelieved so much of the time. Like, I just wanted to thank you for writing this book because it meant a lot to me as I was reading it.
Thank you. I needed to share my view of the world because there is this, I don't know, let's call it cognitive dissonance. It's one of these things where the least enlightened among us, and there are a lot of that, but even if you're one of the good guys, right? If it doesn't happen to you, you don't necessarily believe that it's true. And if you can't put yourself in anyone else's shoes and have any empathy whatsoever, you don't believe it until it happens to you, which is why when certain people of certain political leanings want to enforce these laws against other people, until it happens to them, then they feel differently. It's fucking disgusting. And it has to be spoken about because it doesn't end. And until, you know, I can't even say until, because not enough good men step up and put their bros in their place, because those type of people are only going to listen to other men. So there are a number of them out there, and I appreciate good men a lot, because when they speak up, they get listened to. We don't get fucking listened to, do we? No. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. So every woman listening to this, everyone who identifies as female or non-binary, or anyone who is made to feel small. And I wrote in a dedication that is basically exactly what I'm saying right now. Like, this book is for you. Take up space. Use your voice. Stop making yourself smaller for others. You're only going to suffer. And I hope you feel better. Yeah.
That sort of reminds me of the tagline for your short Disco Graveyard that I was checking out. Don't be dead. The dead are dumb. Be weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I love that as a sentiment. Like, with Finn in I Can See Your Lies, like, accepting who she is, even if it's, like, kind of weird and dangerous, what she can do with her abilities is amazing, if terrifying.
Yeah, it's terrifying. And Finn is a character who is gifted with both a cursed and blessed ability to tell when people are lying to her by seeing physical manifestations of these lies in the form of black oily bubbles popping on their faces. Terrifying, but also useful. And really sad.
Especially when she goes noir detective.
Yeah, it's really sad, but it's like, what are you going to do about it? It comes from being painfully and emotionally aware of when the temperature drops in the room, when being able to tell when maybe someone's not telling you the truth, or is hiding something, or maybe not telling you the whole truth, or whatnot. And, you know, that's another childhood blessing and curse. You know, if you grow up in an environment that is not emotionally safe to you, then you have to learn at a very, very young age how to keep yourself safe. And you don't even know what that fucking means when you're young. It becomes what we call hypervigilant. And a lot of people that I know working in horror, most, if not all, at least people who have talked to me about it, come from narcissist parents and places of abuse. And they are deeply, deeply sensitive and kind souls who recognize when things may not always be true. So we develop a very, very high emotional IQ. It's not quite mind reading, you know what I mean? Because I think that's more or less impossible, but we can suss out people. We can read them pretty well.
It's like sussing out the vibe of how the air has changed.
Exactly.
And I certainly don't know anything about that myself. Intuitive alarm bell that's very hard to explain to people who've never experienced it because they have no reason to think that they're not safe.
Right. Yeah. And your body, even after you're fine, years or decades later, your body will continue and your mind will continue to act the same way as if you're not safe. This is called survival mode.
Mm-hmm.
It fucking sucks. So you have to do a lot of work to grow, to care yourself and get out of that. And so I've put a lot of that in my own work because I think it's important to help other people realize, you know, that someone else is going through the exact same thing or a similar thing too, and that they're not alone because it's really fucking hard to put myself out there like that, to be that fucking vulnerable. But I do it anyway because I think it's important. I try to be the person I needed when I was growing up that I didn't have. So here we are.
I think that's the best thing we can aspire to be in our own lives. Like, be the person that your younger self needed to see. And thank you for being you.
Oh, thanks so much.
You're welcome. So something I'm always curious about with books, because I'm a very, very visual person, sometimes I'll try to cast it with like actors for the characters as I'm going along. And I was curious if you do that too.
Sometimes I do. I can tell you that the character of Roy is based on Tom Hiddleston.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, British actor, really incredible talent. And has worked with a friend of mine. So if the universe wants to gift me with any gifts, I would love to work with Tom someday because he works with a lot of female directors. He's incredible. I've heard so much about him behind the scenes, about what a sweet, kind person he is. So I would love to work with Tom.
He seems like a gentle soul kind of person.
Yeah, exactly. In terms of a few other people in the book, a couple of friends, you know, maybe, who I won't say, but like pieces of here and there, but they might not necessarily like that. So I need to keep that close. But I'm trying to think of like, who would I cast that is, you know, generally well known in, you know, that role? It's not something I've been able to give a ton of thought of because all of my days have been filled with House of Ashes, raising money, and then prep, and then right now production, and then post.
Entirely fair.
Emma Stone could be insanely wonderful in that role.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
God, I love Emma Stone.
She's fantastic. You know, same with Jessica Chastain. Anyone that goes to dark places where they can access
deep emotions. We call that character work, and it's the deep character work, this type of a role.
It would require it.
Oh my God. And it's not easy to go to these places. It's painful. Generally, if your character is not having a great time, you, the human, the actor, is not going to have a great time either. It will be cathartic in some places, especially if there's some sort of earned vengeance or agency that you can access within the story. But if the character is suffering, then the person usually is 100% really suffering as well, one way or another. We've had to, on this film, sit down and talk a lot about circumstances, and I've had to check in, be like, are you okay? What do you need from me? Do you need to spend a few minutes alone to decompress? And here's a tissue or three.
And so, right.
You know, and let me go tell my crew to settle down so we can have a peaceful moment. Yeah, it's a lot of emotional tap dancing doing this type of work, but it's really meaningful.
I feel like that's an aspect of movies that, like, consumers don't often consider, is the bleed that actors get into their real life from trying to inhabit these roles for such intense periods of time. They're human too, and they need to decompress, and they need to, you know, compartmentalize it in their own way. But that's such an amazing skill that I have incredible amounts of respect for.
It's a weird thing to do. I used to act myself, primarily stage. I stopped for a couple of reasons, but one of the reasons I stopped acting was because I had a really difficult time shaking off the emotions of characters that I would play. And that is a thing that happens, not just to me, but to a lot of actors. And it's difficult. And when I say, like, I have to get out of this really dark mindset because of this book and this movie to something lighter, it's the same thing. It's not easy to go to these places for sustained periods of time. You become more or less these people. If you're a method actor, like, that is terrifying. I don't recommend that. I don't recommend method acting. It's essentially assimilating an entirely different world's personality, career, habit, and I don't think that it's necessarily really healthy, especially if you're in dark, dark worlds.
Doesn't sound super healthy, but I'm not a psychiatrist.
No, no. And I probably will have method actors, like, being mad at me now, but, like, do what you gotta do to access what you need to do, but at the same time, it is called acting for a reason.
You do you, but please take care of yourself.
Yeah, no, exactly. Like, please don't suffer more. Like, I wish I could suffer less in making my art. I truly do. But I have to tell myself, all right, look, you're in the dark just now. There will be something to look forward to later. There will be some sunlight. There will be some levity. There will be other things. But man, it becomes a slog. It's very, very difficult to get through some of these days.
How much do you deal with the soundtracks for your films? Did you have a soundtrack in mind for I Can See Your Lies? Maybe a more classic ambient horror thriller with some strings and, like, theremin and stuff? Or, like, maybe a noir-style synth beat for, like, the detective bits? I don't know. Did you have, like, a playlist that you kept going back to while you were writing for inspiration?
I listen to a lot of soundtracks when I write, and most of those soundtracks are ambient soundtracks, really moody, beautifully crafted work. I listen to a lot of Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross soundtracks. They are just incredible soundscapes, and they create moods that are just, I don't know how they do it. I attempted to be a musician myself here and there, and I enjoyed it, but it wasn't like anything I was ever going to pursue for a sustained period of time. I love musicians. You know, I love them. I love how they can, like an actor, they access emotions just in a different medium, like a writer, like a director, like a painter, like, you know, whatever the medium is. I have a longtime composer. His name is Shane Grin. He lives up in Montreal. He's worked on most of my shorts. We're talking about House of Lies right now, and I generally build playlists from soundtracks and
things here and there. It's like a moody synth, perhaps ambient band kind of combination, like Boy Harsher is fucking great.
Mm.
I'll toss that on an inspirational playlist and I'll share it with him or like my crew. Or in the case of House of Ashes, I had a Kickstarter perk that was one of the things in there. But we talk about a lot of moods. We talk about what needs to be accomplished in terms of, all right, what's the feeling here? What's the emotion? What is the emotional landscape that we can try to access? And let's have a discussion about, all right, like, what is a reference point, perhaps, in terms of what kind of direction we want to go to? Do you want to do like a Gone Girl soundtrack type thing here with some droning ambience until it amps up slowly into a crescendo of stabbing terror? Or is it going to be more of a lilting up and down elegant flow of wintry depression mood, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Softer. It's softer and it's sad and it feels like the color blue. And I wrote about the color blue in one scene for I Can See Your Lies, blue being the setting of a big part of the book is up in Arch Cape, Oregon, which I've actually never been, but it's beautiful. It has a beautiful coast. It has like these huge, huge alien-looking, volcanic-looking rocks that come up out of the sea right on the coast, like on Cannon Beach. It just feels like off-season. If you're in a certain mood and it's cold, everything is going to look blue, taste blue, feel blue. You know what I mean? Smell blue, perhaps, yeah, with a sea salt air. I write about it. And I would go to Shane and be like, hey, what? And I would say these types of things to him. And since I've worked with him so long, like, we kind of have a shorthand. And he'd be like, oh, here's a track from, let's say, the soundtrack of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, directed by David Fincher, and mm-hmm. soundtrack composed by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. I'm like, fuck yeah, that's what I'm talking about. And, you know, he'll do something different, but with a similar mood. So that's kind of how I work with soundtracks and music. He's a really talented musician, and so he can work in, like, pretty much any medium. Like, he's done, like, weird Hawaiian guitar stuff for me, you know, for an ironic scene with a pig bursting out of a man's belly, which was my first real short film called Legitimate. Harking back to the term legitimate fucking rape by Senator Todd Akin, which, there's the tiniest little Easter egg with that guy's last name in this movie, because the movie's about holding women down and jailing them for having miscarriages and all sorts of other fucking delights we have in the ever terrifying country of the United States of America.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we're not okay. Nothing is fucking okay here. No. So, anyway. I don't yet know a lot of what we'll be doing for the soundtrack of House of Ashes. I do have a playlist that I've given him for inspiration. We haven't gotten to post yet, so I'm not certain. You know, it's just a process.
If you woke up in a pocket dimension that existed your perfect day for writing, what would that environment be like? What would you want to help you get into that focus state for prose, for screenwriting, for whatever you're writing that day?
I don't think that there's an ideal environment for me or an ideal situation or day. I think if I look at it that way, I might fall into a trap of if things are never ideal, I'm not going to sit down and write.
Mm-hmm.
Because I used to be that way. Like, oh my God, I need to be really inspired. And a lot of people think that way and they never end up having quote unquote good enough inspiration to go and sit down and create something. It's a very hard thing to parse sometimes, and it can be a trap. So be wary of that. However, when the inspiration strikes, of course you're going to write. But I think the act of like, all right, what am I thinking of in terms of have I been terrorized by lately in this country? And how does that make me feel? And what if this happened? And what if that happened? But also, how about this? And then these things sort of mix together to bake like an anarchist cake, because I like, you know, speaking truth to power and talking back and fighting for myself and others. And I think authority is something to be wary of, especially when it's wielded by one group for thousands of years.
No, I've watched some cyberpunk content. I understand.
Yeah, of course. But I would be happiest sitting down to write if I were in a content mood. I think, you know, again, the notion of the suffering artist, it unfortunately is a stereotype because a lot of the time it's true, at least for me. I would love to be happier. I would love to be more content. I would love to have some music. I'd like to have my tea. I'd like to have it be like a beautiful day, or maybe it's a stormy day, and that, because that's really kind of a mood and awesome too.
It's nice and atmospheric.
Yeah, I love atmosphere. I love music. I'm not one of those people that can go write at coffee shops. I find everything really loud and distracting, and I don't really like hanging out with people I don't know. You know what I mean? Like strangers.
That's
or whatever.
A mood.
I get annoyed really easily by that kind of environment, and people having loud conversations around me or whatever is just way, way, way too distracting for me to ever want to even bother. Like, I love being at home writing because I can have my tea and I can have a snack and I don't have to like pay a 500% markup for each. Stupid. And I can have my own music. No one's going to interrupt me. I don't have a man talking to me when I have my headphones on, like for whatever the fuck a reason that is. And it's just stupid things.
They never seem to see the headphones.
Oh my God. They're so obvious too.
Thank God I'm gay. Has yeah. Finn ever considered that?
You know, most of my characters are either partially or secretly bi.
They just need to get to the awakening portion of their story, right?
Yeah. The lead character in my film House of Ashes is bi. And it's like there may be a reference in there, but I wrote a very long backstory for my two leads. And that was part of hers. After, you know, the events in this film end, she's definitely going back to woman.
Nice. Good for her.
Good for her. Yes. There are going to be a lot of good for her moments at the very end. I think you're going to enjoy it.
You can't see me, but I pumped my fist.
Awesome.
In the spirit of your meeting with David Bowie, if you were a sandwich...
Oh my God.
What kind of sandwich would you be?
Oh God. I would probably be a lobster roll with toasted brioche and some tarragon butter and some CBD with seasoned sweet potato fries and maybe a chipotle dip sauce. How about that? And now I want to eat that right now because I'm hungry.
Oh, I'm so sorry. That is such an amazing answer.
Oh, thank you.
I never would have... a lobster roll would not have occurred to me. Izzy, thank you so much for sitting down with me during your very, very busy life. I really appreciate it. And is there anything that you'd like to leave the listeners with?
Well, thank you again, as well as Allie. I really appreciated this.
It was a pleasure.
Oh, thank you. Me too. I would say, dear listener, if you like this conversation, please go and check out my work. Read my book. And if you like the book or the film, come say hi online, you know? I think there's a lot of... social media can be, my God, a trap. There's a lot of blah, blah, blah. I hate this thing. I hate that thing. Blah, blah, blah. And it creates such a terrible environment. Why do you have to feel the need to scream or tag a creator about how much you hate their work? Reversely, if you like something, tell that creator, because mm-hmm. we don't get a lot of affirmations. And sometimes it can actually really sadly mean the difference between a very good day or a terrible day. And also, like, why not spread more joy in the world? Like, come
absolutely.
On, that's awesome. And, you know, create something yourself if you feel like you want to do it. You don't have to do anything well, like be like Mr. Rogers, like just create for you. You don't have to be amazing at it. It is a healing process. It is a therapy process. It is a wonderful thing, and it can put you in a great flow state, and it can make you just feel better. Also, like, again, if you are not feeling great about your place in the world, about how people treat you, like, a little every day, stand up for yourself or someone else and just fucking refuse. Refuse to take it.
Be that change you want to see.
That's right. Exactly. So, be well, friends. Be well, be weird. be yourself, because there's no room for anybody else, right?
Listeners, thank you so much for spending your time with us in this exclusive interview with Izzie Lee. Pre-order her new book, I Can See Your Lies, at the link in the description, releasing February 13th, 2024. And in the meantime, you can catch up on her short story and haunted reels, The Beginning, also linked for your convenience. If you've enjoyed this episode, please consider giving us a 5-star rating and review through the podcatcher of your choice. We'll be featuring reviews right here in the outro going forward to thank you for your time and effort. If you're craving more dark sci-fi and horror, please visit us at darkmattermagazine.shop. This podcast has been a production of Dark Matter Audio Lab, produced by myself, Ali Nova, and executive produced by Rob Carroll and Phil McLaughlin. Please join us again in 2 weeks, where I sit down with author Tracy Cross, as we talk about books 1 and 2 in her Conjure series, Rootwork, and upcoming, A Gathering of Weapons, as well as an excerpt from Rootwork's audiobook, available on Audible. The link is in the description. See you in 2 weeks.